This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Richard Guy Wilson joins me live in studio. He is an architectural historian, the Commonwealth Chair, Department of Architectural History in the School of Architecture at the University of Virginia, a prolific author and scholar, the author of numerous books, including Thomas Jefferson's Academical Village. Richard, it really is a thrill to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
Let me start first. We want to talk in this hour all about Thomas Jefferson's masterpiece, the University of Virginia, and his architecture and his imprint on American architecture. Let's start, though, with your career and give us a quick Richard Guy Wilson 101, where you're from. And when, I'm curious, when at what point in your life did you realize, hey, I really want to do this. I'm good at this. This is what I want to do.
Well, I'm still not quite sure if I'm good at it. Very briefly, I'm a Californian and have been going east, young man, or now old man, most of my life. But I was born in a very, very modern house in California, which looking back, I can see that that was part of it. But the real eye-opener to me was I was in the Navy in Newport, Rhode Island, and it was seeing the incredible architecture there that really began to say, gee, this is really pretty neat. And then after I got out of the Navy and went to the University of Michigan, and I discovered, my God, I might be able to make a living out of studying this stuff, which was it. And so that's how it happened.
There you go. And you came to the University of Virginia in Charlottesville in the mid-1970s when it was still somewhat of a little sleepy university town. It hadn't really exploded yet.
That's true, though the Main Street had been mauled. There was the hardware restaurant downtown, and things were beginning to happen here, certainly. The architecture school was a very good school. I felt very lucky to be coming, and it was especially interesting because there was a department of the history of architecture, which is fairly rare at American universities. Normally, we're swallowed up either in architecture schools or in art history departments. But to actually have a department that focuses on the history of architecture and historic preservation is unique. And so I've always felt very lucky about that.
And one of the best, one of the very best schools of its kind in the world right here at the University of Virginia. Let's talk about Jefferson's Academical Village. And before we get into some specifics and how it happened, we want to let folks know that there are currently two exhibits at the university that folks can check out. Tell us about those.
There is one exhibit at the University Art Museum in the Bailey Building. Some people may know it as the Bailey Art Museum, but the name has been changed, and Rugby Road. And that exhibit is about 70 original drawings, many by Mr. Jefferson himself and by other individuals, and letters that deals with the creation of the university and the design of it. And so that is one exhibit there. It is up until January 3rd, and the museum is open from noon until 5 o'clock every day except Mondays. And then concurrent with it, though it will last longer, is over at the Special Collections Library, the Harrison Small Building, which is next door to Alderman. That's where the rare books are. An exhibit called From Village to Grounds, Architecture After Jefferson at the University. And that exhibit, which I did with a number of students, we put together really the there is something other than Jefferson at the University of Virginia.
Right.
And it covers the tracing of the history of other buildings up until tomorrow. Indeed, we have buildings that aren't completed that are in the exhibit.
Yeah, fantastic.
So there are two exhibits, and the Special Collections is open every day except on Sundays, and it will be open all next term, and I encourage everybody to go see both of them. The one right away, because it's not going to be up but about another month.
Yeah, at the Art Museum. Yep. We're honored to be talking with Richard Guy Wilson, architectural historian at the University of Virginia. And among his numerous books is Thomas Jefferson's Academical Village. The phone lines are open if you've got a question or a comment. Richard, the exhibit at the Art Museum that explores a lot of these original drawings and looks at how this masterpiece actually was created on the ground and that evolving process over many years to create this beautiful, beautiful facility. What do you think is most surprising to people when they start looking at the history of this process of Jefferson's work? What really jumps out at people, and what do you think is particularly interesting?
Well, there are several things. One is that you can see him literally thinking in the drawings, that you can see him making changes in them, cutting parts out, pasting things in. In other words, of course, this was a point in time when you didn't have Xerox machines. Paper was a scarce commodity, a valuable commodity. But you can literally see him pasting things over, cutting out parts of drawings, let's say. And so that, I think, is one element that is. The second thing is that you begin to realize, and it does take some time to look at the exhibit, is that it's a long process. It wasn't something that was, oh my gosh, I've got this idea, and whammo, we go out and we build it. It's a long process. The process here, specifically in Charlottesville or Albemarle County, begins in 1814 and doesn't conclude to 1826. But then there is a larger picture of Jefferson's interest in education, which goes back, on one level, you might say back to 1779 when he was governor and proposes that the state ought to take on the responsibility of education of the populace with a three-tiered system of which the upper level was going to be a state-sponsored college. And, of course, the state legislature then isn't too much different than the state legislature today. Nothing much gets done. But they did not do anything. But he gets this reputation, of course, as an educator.
Right. And they criticized him at the time. This is just some big government scheme. Yeah, we don't want to spend money on
education.
Right.
And but, I mean, you can also, I think, even push it back a little bit further, if you want, to his time at the College of William & Mary. I mean, he was down there for 3 years between 1760 and 1763. And the College of William & Mary was all housed in one big building, the Wren Building, which is the end of the Duke of Gloucester Street. And there was about 40 students. The faculty, which with one exception, were all men of the cloth. It was an Anglican institution. I mean, all institutions of higher learning in this country until really after the Civil War are church-controlled. Even if it's a state institution, that's the reason why we're so unique. But even like Chapel Hill, where is it? New York, North Carolina. It's in Chapel Hill.
Right.
It was the Presbyterians down there. But at the College of William and Mary, everybody was in this one gigantic large building, and that's where they ate and they slept and they took courses. And the descriptions of life in there are sort of similar to Rugby Road in a Friday or Saturday night here in town. And the Animal House type of thing.
Yeah.
And so if you think about that.
And he never really liked that, did he?
No. Yeah. But if you think about that, everybody crammed into one building, and then what he begins to suggest, and there's a series of letters from people writing in, say, from Ohio, Tennessee, to him while he's as president, and we're going to establish an institution. And he writes back, avoid a single large building. They're injurious to health. And so in a sense, and I try to explain that to some degree, all art is a certain degree autobiographical. And in this sense, this is the antithesis of his educational experience that he is creating here at the university. For instance, down at College of William & Mary, they had these men of the cloth, and one of them loved nothing better than to get the young men a little liquored up and lead in a charge against the townspeople, town-gown relationships. Now, let me just say before anybody, this is not unique. I mean, this is the town-gown problems are everywhere.
Sure.
And so forth. But in other words, he isn't going to have any clergymen here, and we did not. We were very unique. It was not until McGuffey comes in the late 1830s that we get our first clergyman as a faculty member at UVA. But if you go to most if you were a student at most American universities up until after the Civil War, you were probably being taught by a man who had a divinity degree of some sort.
We're talking with Richard Guy Wilson, architectural historian at the University of Virginia. And Richard, that's one of the reasons why the university was so controversial. A lot of the conservatives in Virginia at the time said, "You're spending public money on what?" And there's no, and there's one account from the, I think it's 1830, where this woman visits the university and she refers to it as the University of Vagabonds,
right?
Because everyone insisted you don't have any clergy there, so you're going to have problems. So that when there were the normal type of problems that universities have, they blamed it on the fact that there wasn't a chapel on grounds, right, and you weren't having clergy teach the classes.
No, and that's in 1831, there was a proposal to put a chapel on the grounds. We don't have any drawings of it. It probably was intended for the middle of the lawn. There is, in the exhibit over at Harrison Small, I have a rendering of a Gothic chapel to be stuck right in the middle of the lawn between pavilions 9 and 10.
Oh, my goodness.
And this was designed by a man named William Pratt, and this was a fundraiser for it. Because, of course, religion still does play a big role in American life,
sure,
certainly. But, for instance, the Episcopal Bishop of Virginia, Bishop Meade, preached a sermon in the Rotunda in 1829 and said, "The Almighty is angry. He will destroy this place." And there had been a yellow fever epidemic, but there was the feeling that there was a bunch of heathens up here in Charlottesville that were being trained. And so we ultimately, of course, did get a chapel. Thank goodness. It's a very lovely building. It's not in the middle of the ground. Off to the side. But you know, this was a big deal, a really big deal.
Yeah. And that, of course, mollified the complaints for a little bit. But there was still a lot of concern.
I mean, let me just go on and just say for a minute here, there's always a question about Jefferson and his religion and so forth. And you're going to get a lot of stories on it. My take on it is, yes, he does believe in some supreme being. At the same time, he has questioned some of the miracle type of things.
Yeah.
He actually does try to rewrite the Bible to cut out a lot of those. But he did not forbid. There were religious services held at the university during his lifetime, while he was alive, and they would continue to be held here. What he projected was that if the Baptists or the Episcopalians wanted a school, they would establish one here in Charlottesville, and that what he was projecting was a sort of Oxford or Cambridge type of thing of a bunch of individual colleges. But that has not been, with a couple of minor exceptions, the American model for higher education. Instead of that, the places go big.
Yeah. We're talking with Richard Guy Wilson at the University of Virginia. To get back to that the University of Virginia was the antithesis of his experience as a student in Williamsburg. Instead of one big building, instead of clergy, we would have scholars and scientists teaching in multiple buildings arranged around a common green space, which was common at the time with universities, and it would be a little village.
Yeah, right, academical village. He uses that term, academical village. Let me warn you, if you put it in your computer and put a spell check on it, it's not going to like academical. I can't help it. He spelled it that way. But no, he sees this as – he also was scared because College William & Mary and most universities are in the middle of a city, you understand, and so that town-gown thing. And so he moved the University of Virginia out of Charlottesville. I mean, why he was scared about Charlottesville is beyond me, because it was sort of a podunky little place of just a couple hundred people. But still, we are 3 miles – you know, literally from downtown out there at the university. And so he was worried about that. In other words, this was to be not isolation, but it was to be removed and where you could study. And he also projects a very unique, interesting idea. You will specialize. And that's something that a lot of people forget. But he said you shall come and you'll specialize in a discipline, because normally when you went to school, everybody just studied one course for the first year, one course. You did Latin, you did Greek. Everybody did the same damn thing all the way along.
Right.
And he wanted to have the specialization. And that's what he sets it up to do.
But, what we would think of today as a major.
Yeah, a major. Yeah. Right. But see, majors don't come in this country until after the Civil War for most schools, when we begin to imitate the German system. And it is interesting when the first studies are really being done on this in the 1880s by the Department of Education, the man who writes it says, you know, Jefferson thought of this 60 years ago. So he was prescient in many ways.
Yeah, indeed. We're honored to be talking with Richard Guy Wilson, architectural historian at the University of Virginia. We're going to take a break here at the bottom of the hour, get a local news update and a weather update, and we'll continue this conversation on the other side. Richard, when we get back, let's talk more about how the design process of the university, the building process. And before we let you go, we're going to talk about the future of the university as well, vis-a-vis historic preservation and what's going on the lawn now and what the rotunda could possibly look like in the future. Very, very different. This is Charlottesville Right Now, News Radio 1070 WINA. This is Charlottesville Right Now, News Radio 1070 WINA.
We barefootin'.
Let's rejoin our conversation with Richard Guy Wilson. He's the Commonwealth Chair in the Department of Architecture at the University of Virginia, prolific author, among his many books, Thomas Jefferson's Academical Village, and we're honored to have him here with us. Tell us a little bit about the evolution of the design and the process, which took many years, and as you point out, it really began here in Central Virginia in 1814 with plans for what was then the Albemarle Academy, which became Central College, which in 1819, of course, became the University of Virginia. But tell us about that process, that Jefferson designing a school.
Well, what you can see in the exhibition, and this again is one of the fascinating elements, is the way he starts out with one scheme for the Albemarle Academy, which is a big U-shaped complex of about 9 houses for professors and the dormitory rooms for the students in between. And it measured 257 yards by 257 yards, which in other words is about 2.5 Scott stadiums long and wide. And if you think about the lawn today, it's about 185 to 190 feet across. And so there's a big shift that happens in between there. And so one of the things is that you can see him starting off with an idea, and then they get a site. And the site is a hilly site. This ain't going to fit there. And so then they have to begin to maneuver. You also see him reaching out for suggestions. He writes a letter to Dr. William Thornton, who was the first architect of the United States Capitol and was a friend of Jefferson's. He writes a letter to Benjamin Henry Latrobe, who was the second architect of the United States Capitol and also a buddy and a friend of Jefferson's, asking for ideas. And their letters come back, and you can see the way that Jefferson picks up some of their ideas, modifies them, and uses them. It shows, I think, two things. One is, he just sold his library to Congress in 1816, so he didn't have his books, and that was a problem. And he was, a bibliomaniac of the first order.
That must have been incredibly frustrating him. At a time when he needed his architecture books most, he doesn't have them.
Right. So he immediately goes out and starts trying to buy them again, but this isn't Amazon or Barnes & Noble that you can just pop, go get them. But he does buy back some of the books. We have letters where he borrows books from people to use and so forth. The other thing is I think that it shows an ability to say, this is a big deal. I need some help. It's not a bad idea to reach out and get some suggestions from other people. And sometimes that's something that we all tend to forget. So you do see him picking up these ideas. There's a series of wonderful drawings where you can see him trying to work out the relationship between the pavilions and the dormitory rooms and the gardens and the ranges behind, and the way that he takes a drawing and he cuts it up and slides another piece in, and then he brings that out, he slides another piece in. Now, of course, again, this is a point in time when you don't have Xerox machines. Yeah. He's having to laboriously draw all of this stuff. I'm not going to redraw all of this damn thing. So you can see him doing, you can literally see him thinking through things. There are drawings in which he pastes something on over something. So as I say, it takes some study, but what you come away with is, A, the full immersion of the man in this, but that this isn't just a, you know, an absolute first idea type of thing. It's an evolution.
It truly did evolve over many years, yeah. We're talking with Richard Guy Wilson of the University of Virginia, noted architectural historian. Richard, talk some about just the actual construction. I've read somewhere you were referring to the fact that this was one of the largest construction projects in America at the time, just out in the middle of nowhere.
Right. Yes, I mean, of course, this is a rural area down here, and this is a – for instance, Washington, D.C. was being reconstructed after the British burned it in 1814. The other thing that you have that's big is the Erie Canal across upstate New York, but I would put this up there in a league with those. We know we have in the exhibit – this is one of the things that is, I think, most interesting – is we have a list of about 300 names of individuals who worked on this. In some cases, we know pretty clearly who they were, though it is interesting. Out of these, we only have only what one person actually looked like. In other words, but you do get, and these are names we've dug out of the records at the university, but in some cases we just have a name such as Ben. And Ben was hired from Blake Harris, probably enslaved.
Right.
Then we have Billy, and the only description of him is Negro. And so you go from one level to another level. But these were the individuals. Now, these aren't all. We know that there are other people who were really working as subcontractors or working under some of these individuals and were being paid, and the head guy was being paid, and then he was putting it on down. But probably 600 people worked on this, and that's a big project.
Wow, yeah.
And also to think that the brick is all being done here. The timber's always coming here. But your glass – your hardware, the elaborate capitals that were on the rotunda and in the fronts of some of the pavilions, Pavilion 2, 3, 8, these have these wonderful capitals on there. They were actually carved in Italy by the Ragai boys who had actually come over here. Jefferson had hired them to come over to carve, and he took them – asked him to go look at some local stone, and they said, are you crazy? This stone isn't any good. And so finally they went back and they carved these, and then they were shipped across the Atlantic, and with all of this stuff comes into Norfolk, offloaded there, comes up the James River as far as Richmond, offloaded there because of the falls, then on up to James River to Scottsville, then put on skiffs and brought up to Ravenna here, because that's the way you transported stuff
at
that point in time. Some of these capitals were so big and so heavy they couldn't fit on the boats, and so they had to be brought in overland, which shows, you might say, the impracticality or the obsession of Jefferson with the architectural elements of the place.
We're talking with Richard Guy Wilson, architectural historian of the University of Virginia. We're honored to have him live in studio. What of the library? We were talking during the break how this was the first time of any university where the library really was the signature building and took center stage.
Right. We did not have a chapel here, and the rotunda, the top of it, the dome, was the brain, the mind of the university. It is interesting, if you think of the building, it's based upon the Pantheon in Rome, which was a temple, a Roman temple. Later, if you ever go there, it's still open. They still have an open oculus. If it's raining outside, the rain's going to come in. The way that the heavens were seen through this was part of their religion, and the way that the sun came through and moved around. And then, of course, the dome becomes the dome of Christianity, St. Paul's in Rome, St. Peter's, St. Peter's in Rome, St. Paul's in London. And now it becomes the dome of the Enlightenment. It becomes the dome of knowledge and so forth. And so it's an interesting transition here of, I think, a symbol that goes on.
Yeah. And built as the library And yet, the minute it's built, how do you add more books to it?
Right. Jefferson came up with not only with the curriculum for the university, but a list of 8,500 books that the library should have. That doesn't seem like many books for us today, but should keep in mind that, for instance, Harvard University, which was about 180 years old at that point in time, had in their library only 30,000 volumes. Brown University, which was about 60 years old at that time, only had 4,000 books in their library. So Jefferson's projection of 8,500. But the problem was that he couldn't foresee that right at that point in time, there was a revolution taking place in the production of paper. That paper, which had been a scarce and a pricey commodity, gets reduced in price. And secondly, revolutions in book publishing, steam press, ways of laying type. And so you get cheaper books, much cheaper books, and a proliferation of books. And here he has got this library, not him, but here we've got this library designed for 8,500 or maybe 10,000 books. And all of a sudden you've got 17,000, 20,000, 30,000 books. What do you do? How do you add to a circle? Well, that's a problem. And so it shows to some degree slightly the architectural limitations of it.
Yeah. And then, of course, they didn't answer that question until the 1930s, when 1938, when Alderman Library was built. And still, they had to add on to that, and then they had to build another library.
Add on to that, and add on to that, and how many libraries have got scattered around the grounds?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Richard, talk some about architectural preservation, historic preservation at the university, and what's going on now. Because this is fairly controversial, especially among the alumni of Mr. Jefferson's University, who aren't used to, will have to get used to the idea of seeing perhaps in the future a very different looking university.
Yes, if you go up to the university today and go down the east side of the lawn to Pavilion 10, there's scaffolding up on it. It will come down in about another 3-4 weeks, you will see a very different a set of columns there that are gray or stone colored in stone color, and they've done a considerable amount of research. The office of the architect David Newman and the preservationists up there done a considerable amount of research and come up with we knew this for a while, but that all of the columns were gray. They were sand-colored on there. The problem with them, they are brick core with a thin skim coat of plaster or stucco on it. And the problem is that stucco can crack. You throw a frisbee and it knocks it. Shoot a gun. okay. Anyway, they got banged up. And so what do you do? And so you began to come through and whitewash them. And so beginning in probably the 1840s, they began whitewashing the columns and so forth. And so our image of the university's red brick and white trim, white columns, is really wrong. Jefferson would never have known that. These would have been all gray. And so what we have started off is down at Pavilion 10 is restoring the front of that. There were actually two columns done up a little bit closer about 10 years ago by Murray Howard, who was the preservation architect then, to show really what this is going to look like. And the hope is that this will be continued on. It's expensive, needless to say, but that we will in time change the entire thing there. And it will make a big difference. And yes, some alums, as all of us, this is the way I remember things. That's the way it must have always been. But the facts are that it's very different. You go up to Monticello and look at his columns at Monticello, either side, they're not white, they're sand-colored.
Interesting. It'll look completely different, though.
Yeah, it'll look very different.
Tell me about the dome, too, because it's likely in the future that won't be white either.
Right. Well, of course, the rotunda burned in the big fire of April.
October 1895.
October, yeah.
Right.
1895. And the reconstruction was carried out by the New York firm of McKim, Mead, and White, with Stanford White as the lead architect on it. And there are slight changes in the exterior of the building, very slight changes. The interior was dramatically changed with a big two-story space, which then in the 1970s, under the leadership of Frederick Nichols, Freddie Nichols. It was restored back to the Jefferson. But there are, we've discovered now that there are a lot of other things that are wrong with it, and they're going to have to be taken care of. The dome shouldn't be white. Probably a copperish, greenish type of a color is really what should be up there on the dome. And again, that's going to be controversy.
Yeah. Now, what is your personal feelings about it? As I guess as an architectural historian, you'd like to see as close to the original as possible?
Yes. Well, I think that there are two sides to any story in historic preservation. One is that you preserve the changes that have gone on over time. And there is a validity to that. I think that to do away with the Stanford White stuff totally would be very wrong. But alternatively, I think that the Jefferson basis of the lawn and so forth is far more important than, say, this whitewash that was sort of indiscriminately. And, I mean, some of those columns have had 150 coats of paint on them. And if you walk over there and walk down there, you can see just, you know, how what bad shape this is. And we need to take care of them. We've got to take care of this because one of the problems is that the paint's put on doesn't allow them to breathe the way they should. And so we're having deterioration of brick and so forth. And
in the core.
Brick, yeah, in the core.
Of the columns, yeah.
And so we need to take care of that. Also, the railings that are up, the so-called Chinese Chippendale railings, they were replaced in the 1970s and were not done accurately. And we discovered if you go out and you look, you'll see that they don't line up with the columns down below. Jefferson would never have that. I can guarantee you that there would be an alignment of these parts. But alternatively, let me just say that there's another side to this, and that is that each of the fronts of these pavilions is different. You have Doric across from Ionic. You have the Temple Fortuna Virilis across from the Hadrian's Baths, Trajan's Baths. You have these differences. And what he was intending was that the environment was as important as the professor blabbing away in the classroom, that you learn from your environment, and that the education does come from what your surroundings are.
Yeah, that the landscape would speak to you.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, and you should learn from that. And I think that that is a very important element, which unfortunately at times I think in modern school design we don't pay much attention to.
Right, right. And that makes me think of his quote that the open view to the south would be symbolic of the limitless freedom of the human mind, and yet so much money left over after the rebuilding fund, rebuilding the rotunda, they built three new school buildings at the foot of the lawn.
Yeah, they put those buildings down there. Let me just say on this case that there is, I think, pretty good evidence that people were very upset by the lack of termination of the end of the lawn. And you do get at many American universities in the beginning of the 1880s, the beginning of the construction of walls, gates, enclosing it from the surroundings. The other thing was is that there were proposals for terminating the lawn. One was that Gothic chapel I mentioned earlier. Another one was a 40-foot-tall statue of Jefferson down there. Another one was a huge triumphal arch, a gigantic triumphal arch. Sort of the Arch of Titus from the Forum in Rome, brought to Charlottesville, but decorated with 1892 Confederates. It would be an arch of the Confederacy. And I think we can say then, I mean, it's wonderful to have, you know, Johnny Reb out in front of the courthouse downtown and so forth, but I think we can say we're pretty glad that we didn't have that erected there. My point is I think something would have been put there.
At some point,
sure. At some point. Something would go there.
Richard Guy Wilson. He is an architectural historian at the University of Virginia, the Commonwealth Chair in the Department of Architectural History, School of Architecture. Among his many books, Thomas Jefferson's Academical Village. And he is the curator of an exhibit at the UVA Art Museum on Rugby Road, which is only going to be up until, what, January 3rd?
Yes.
So we strongly recommend that folks get out and see that exhibit on the evolution and the history of Mr. Jefferson's University. It's been a real thrill to talk to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.